Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase, and today I'm thrilled to bring you the amazingly talented Miss Amalia Ortiz. How are you, Amalia?
I'm good. It's good to be doing something other than working on my graduate school work.
yes, indeed. I would guess that's true. When is your spring break?
My spring break actually started last night, and I spent all of, yesterday working on homework till probably about, 2 in the morning. So, I'm not really going to have a spring break. I look at it as a week where I have no additional assignments, but I have to catch up with the other assignments that I'm lagging on.
Right.
But, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm hopefully going to graduate this May, but I think this happens probably to all graduate students. The last little mile is the hardest, and I'm wearing pajamas every day, and my list of things to do is through the roof, and, stacks of books around me. That's the world I'm living in right now.
Wow. Well, it'll be really worth it when you get that MFA. You'll feel that great sense of achievement. Are you working on a manuscript as part of it? Did you say that to me?
Yes. My first book that just came out, Rant Chant Cheeseman, it represents 15 years of writing, being around spoken word, and so as part of the program, your master's thesis is a manuscript, and so this is pretty much my second book, being produced written over the course of maybe 2 years that I've been focused on just this manuscript. And to me, it's teaching me, forcing me to write in a different way. I think definitely I came up out of the slam world, and so I had these mini soft deadlines. Oh, I want a new poem for this coming slam. Or there's a specialty slam. I want to write on that theme. But there are a lot of times, definitely when I was a younger writer, where I was I'm going to wait to the muse. And even though I worked for a newspaper at one time, I saw poetry deadlines as different. I had to wait for something magical to happen. But now graduate school definitely snapped me out of that, where it's no, you have something to do Wednesday, and then you have something to do Thursday, and, you have a 24-hour turnaround and just somehow make it happen. And so it's forcing me to write in a different way, which is good, because it's showing me that, other ways of working are possible rather than just sit around staring at the screen waiting for that elusive muse. So it's been good for me.
truly, it sounds as if that's true. So you've been working so hard, and really, have you had the opportunity to perform much? And what do the professors for your MFA think of the slam world and you coming from that? Do you find any prejudice?
When I first entered, I entered the program, I wasn't really sure if I even wanted to complete it. I just thought, I'll see what this is like. I had heard from other people who transitioned from performance poetry, the slam world, into academia, that there were prejudices. I saw a few, but I think because I walked in defensive, I was pleased to see, and this is maybe just a product of age. When I first started writing, it was the late 90s. I didn't see too many books by other slammers, and now I've seen quite a few people who I performed with at National Poetry Slams who have gone through the system. They have books out, and the academic world does have some precedence for it. So I wasn't really as much of an anomaly as I thought I would be. I do often have to defend the genre or explain the genre at times, but it wasn't as difficult as I think. I was definitely afraid. And I think the same was true of when I first started writing. I never thought any of this would end up in print. It was, aimed at a live audience and aimed at how the ear would perceive it. And so the MFA has helped at
really stopping to think about, okay, if it is on the page, how do I want people to perceive it when I don't have my voice delivering the message? So that's been that's been good. So it's been easier in some ways than I thought it would be, as far as like defending the slam, because I think we are becoming, or performance, not necessarily poetry slam, but performance poetry is being more and more recognized.
Yes.
But also difficult in other ways, that just at converting this thing to me that was very three-dimensional, how do you flatten that on the page? So that's been a little difficult, yeah.
So have you been completely involved in academia, or are you still performing?
I'm still performing. So since my book came out in December, I've had a few invitations when I can and when it fits my schedule. I am able to travel, promote the book, and perform. And my first love is performing. This semester, because I'm in the last semester, I've had to turn down some of those opportunities. But it's all building to my second manuscript. Is this hybrid collection of poetry and prose poems that's also meant to double as, hopefully you can read it as a book, but it's also going to be a script. And so that's really going to be three-dimensional, and I want to have a performance of it before I graduate to video included in the record of my thesis. So that way people can see that, yes, it's this book, but it's also, it's a script. And so it's kind of the actual idea for this second book is it's a concept album, and it's a collection of, I guess what I would call songs, repurposed. There we go. Repurposed songs. And then in between the songs, there's a narrator telling this story, and it's post-apocalyptic. And there are costumes, and it's a play. It is kind of a punk rock musical in a way.
Wow.
So yeah, I want that to there to be a video record of that included with the manuscript, so that not only my thesis committee, but if anyone else like revisits it, they understand. Yes, this was written to be something you can read, but I very much love and still work and operate in the performance world.
Do you think that you'll be touring at all after you finish your MFA?
Definitely. I want to get the second manuscript, because it is going to be a kind of band-like spoken word project. I want to get that formed. Right now I'm using two musicians, a local drummer, and my husband plays the guitar, but in a perfect world it would be like a 4 or 5-member, all-female band. So I would have to cast that as though it were a play of musicians who would be willing to tour. And this is the project I'm really excited about, like finally emerging from my books and then being able to just go off into the sunset with this weird project and tour it. That would be ideal.
So you sing?
I do for this project, and so this is one of the discussions I've been having with professors is, if I look at it as a musical, ideally, maybe somewhere along the line, I could cast someone else with a better voice, but I feel like as right now, in the very beginning, as it's I'm still polishing it, and then the first like bout of touring it to see how people, I want to be the person on stage seeing how people react so that I can understand what rewrites need to go into it.
Yes.
But yeah, if you can imagine like Hedwig, the people who wrote it, they were the first people to perform it, and then they, now they're, whoever wants to could perform it. Something like that. I don't believe I'm the strongest voice for it, but I feel that I need to be involved in the beginning just to see how people react to it.
Very, very nice. Hey, I was wondering if I could prevail upon you, and, we've already been talking for a good 5 minutes. I would love to have the opportunity to have you read something for us. Would you mind doing that?
Sure. I'm going to read something from the book, Rant, Chant, Chisme. I love that I don't have to be censored, because this poem has some language in it. And I think especially when I'm invited to read at high schools, I have a clean version. But you'll see, there's a part of it where there's like repetition of some words, but it's because I'm playing with the sound and word I'm going to use, I define it. But growing up, my grandmother only spoke to me in Spanish, and I only answered her in English, and so I had to figure out by context what she meant. There was a word that she would call me, and it didn't feel good when she said it because she would yell it, and it was chocante.
So there's a poem about that.
Okay.
Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Chocante, sinvergüenza, without shame. Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Abuela called me chocante so often, I thought chocante was my name. See, chocante means unpleasant. It's true, I'm not out to please. Chocar means to collide or to crash violently. Me chocas, feel a head-on collision at the very sight of me. Cante, I sang. Canto, I sing. Chocante! Too loud, Abuela said. You want way too much attention. Too much for a Mexicana adhering to convention. Abuela taught me to be docile. Told me girls are born to suffer, to cook and clean, not be obscene. Serve the man first at supper. Qué chocante. Yes, Abuela is now rolling in her grave. Mujer muy mal hablada, did you not learn to behave? Señorita misbehaving, señorita misspeaking, señorita chocante, what husband will tolerate your shrieking? Cállate nena cochina, quédate en la cocina, bocona hocicona, mouth too big for una niña, raunchy risque arrastrada, pariah parrandera. Now I'm persona non grata, perhaps they should have named me Chata. Shut the fuck up. Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Chocante sinvergüenza, without shame. Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Abuela called me chocante so often, I thought chocante was my name. Chocante, chocante, cho, cho. Chode is a short dick. Chocante, chocante, cho, cho. Chocha is a woman's slit. Cante, cante, can't chant cunt. Cante, cante, can't smut. I should close my pussy lips. I can't get off on masturbation. Feed my babies with my tits and save the goods for procreation. Choose virgen or choose puta. Can't exist is paradox. Sex, class, race, and education serve to keep me in a box. I'm as subtle as machismo, which is always in my face. Oh, but I'm the one who has the problem. I'm the one who's out of place. Choke, choke, choco. Muy chocante. Abuela said it was an omen. Huerca chueca means I'm twisted, not attractive for a woman. Been called angry because I'm vocal. Yeah, I sure can talk a riot. Been called angry, but I'm happier than when I was afraid and quiet. If you're proud and loud and willful, you're una mujer desgraciada. But a matriarch must first rule herself. Y a mí nadie me manda. Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Chocante sin vergüenza, without shame. Chocante, shocking, startling, strange. Abuela called me chocante so often, well, I believed her. Perhaps she's the one to blame. And that's the end of that.
Mm. Lovely. Just, you know, taking the role of the female and traditional views versus, I guess, coming out of that and being a modern woman. Is this a true story? Did your grandmother call you that all the time?
Yes. And I grew up in, I mean, I don't know how traditional, I was about to say traditional border family, but I only know like my own experience. And it was very extreme because my grandmother raised my brother and I. And my brother was only 2 years older than I. But he was allowed, my grandfather died. My grandfather died, my brother was 14. My brother became the man of the house. And we didn't, even though we lived in the same house, we were totally not treated the same way. My brother could do whatever he wanted, go and come as he pleased. If he wanted to come in, he didn't have like a curfew. If he came in the next morning, that was his business, what he was doing. If he wanted to eat, my grandmother told me, you go ask him what he wants to eat and you make him food. So I'd make my brother breakfast. I was pretty much like, you know, a servant or maid to my brother. And when I questioned this, I was like, well, why does, and I, on the other hand, I had church, school, home, and that was it. I would go to church, school. If I was late from school, where were you? Why were you? It takes you 3 minutes to walk home from school. It's been 5 minutes. Where were you? And so it was, you know, very, very extremely oppressive environment. And when I questioned that, the only explanation was that, well, you're a girl. You're a girl and he's a boy, and that's the way it is. That's the way it's always been. You just don't question that. And my grandmother raised, of her own, she had 12 children. So, you know, my father had 11 siblings. Six women, six men, and that's just the way it was. They accepted it. Those who questioned it, they had, you know, a hard life. One of my aunts, my Aunt Tina, is the famously outspoken one because she was also questioning it in her time growing up. And, so if we the more that we pushed back against it, the more oppressive the environment was. I think she wanted to get us to the point where we would stop questioning. And I think by the time that she raised me, she was just, even though I never really got that equality that I was seeking from her, I probably questioned it the most. And, her reaction was always that I was chocante, which is this, I was the unpleasant one. Unlike, I guess, all of the women she had raised who just pleasantly accepted that was their role. I was, definitely strange and unpleasant.
And at the time,
I had no clue. Yes?
Go ahead, please. No.
No, I was going to say, at the time, I had no idea what the word meant. I just knew it was bad. And it wasn't until I had left home that I even looked up the word. I'm like, oh, that's what she was saying to me. But it felt like, you know, from context, it felt like a car crash when she said I was chocante. And playing with the English words choke, I felt like in some way I was like a collision, a car crash in her world without really ever looking up the word. Until years later.
Wow. What a wonderful context to put that in. Thank you for sharing that. And how much do you think that being a girl who was raised in a border town affected your views of the world and affected the work that you do?
It is the region where I grew up in. Where I'm living now in the South, as you could get in Texas, South Texas border, it is the strongest influence on my writing, probably second to being born female. But probably, you know, along with being born female, because being born female in my culture, in my household, was such an extreme experience. I mean, it affected language and poems, definitely, where there was some Spanish in that. I do have a lot of code switching because that was my experience. In my home, my grandmother would speak to me in Spanish, but then I was encouraged to speak only English so that I would be successful in the United States. And definitely at school, we were not allowed to speak Spanish. I remember it even being looked down upon in the halls. And yet, with the way that students would interact with each other when we weren't at school, like just on the playground, there was that constant code switching. And so it was almost like being two people or being able to slip in and out of two different identities, my American identity and then my Mexican, Tex-Mex identity. Because I wouldn't even say Mexican because my Spanish then was broken because I wasn't taught it formally. But definitely the people who I grew up with, we had kind of a language of our own that was this mix of worlds. Definitely one of the strongest impacts on my worldview. And then I wasn't really even able to cherish it or appreciate it until I left the region to go to college. And then looking back, I'm like, wow, I grew up in a really, you know, I didn't even realize how unique or culturally interesting it was until I was able to leave and move to other places where I'm like, wow, that's not, to realize, that's not really the national norm. It's definitely been one of the strongest impacts on my writing.
I was wondering then, we have about 10 minutes left, and I would love you to read a second piece. Could you do that for us?
You would ask for the primed piece? I'm looking through my set list. Is this the last poem I'm reading? I just want to clarify because I need to choose.
I was thinking that you're still going to read a side of the show if that would be all right with you. Okay.
So that's later. So another poem for now. I got it. I jumped ahead of myself. So when I'm reading locally and in Texas, half of my book is either poems about the border or Texas, and then the other half is, okay, so then one-fourth of it is probably like feminist, my feminist issues, and then there's a fourth of it that, and there's this section called Mestizo American, which is, you know, undeniably I am American and how pop culture and other American phenomena have definitely impacted me.
This is one of those that I haven't read recently. It was about, I actually worked at the Pantages Theater in Los Angeles for a few years, and seeing, getting an insider look to paparazzi and celebrity, I attempted to write this, and this is called The Boulevard. At 4 a.m. on Hollywood Boulevard near Vine, when the gutters are cluttered with glossy nightclub flyers, fast food trash, and random castaway collections of those homeless now huddled up to metal storefront grates, locked and pulled down tight for the night, as a sex shop peep show flashes a neon beacon, when all frolicking at the frolic room has ceased, when the trendy Hollywood scenesters have all stumbled off into the dark to other scenes, when each tourist-leeching T-shirt and trinket pusher has fled, and the busboys have rinsed every last greasy spoon and bussed it home to rest their American dreams in beds far from Hollywood, where the 4 a.m. silence betrays the wild, frantic bustle of daylight sightseers meandering like cattle grazing, hungry eyes scanning the ground for more, more spectacle, more gossip fuel for the celebrity fire, more proof that this filthy boulevard is exceptional. At 4 a.m. On Hollywood near Vine, when the valet's ballet of cars has concluded and there are no buskers keeping time to rattling subway rhythms, no big business heels tapping urgent staccato marches or Katsuya spying paparazzi clicking frenetic bebop tempos, when all the bouncers have bounced on, then the only sounds are the tired whispers of the guardians' tongues, the paid caretakers, porters, janitors, guards, standing dutiful vigil at 4 a.m. on Hollywood Boulevard near Vine. A street cleaner ceremoniously shuffles, his arms swaying like a priest swinging incense during this, his early morning ritual, pressing steadily forward, waving a pressure-cleansing stream, a constant zigzag pattern, past the long-forgotten fallen stars of Edward Dimitrik, Joel McCrea, and Mitchell Leeson. Fans no longer pause for photos alongside Kathleen Lockhart, Marshall Nealon, or Mercedes McCambridge. At 4 a.m. on Hollywood Boulevard near Vine, the grime of the hard-luck hustlers and bleary-eyed beggars is swept away, and the struggle to outdo one another's hustle is temporarily on hold at this corner, which tells time by traffic marks, seasons by wreaths on makeshift headstones, later trampled underfoot by ship-seeking panhandlers and star-chasing dupes. Each a deformed American tragedy, reinforcing the mythology of the velvet rope. Yes, at 4 a.m., this is as clean as these Hollywood streets get.
Lovely. And you went to college then in California?
No, I went to college in San Antonio here. Well, I kind of bounced around in college. But I was in Los Angeles for 5 years while my husband was getting his PhD at UCLA. And so when I moved there, he had that built-in support system of he had his cohort, his professors, other students. He had UCLA as a home base. I had the city. And I didn't know what I was going to do there. I mean, I had poetry, but, you know, changing scenes, especially moving from, you know, the small pond to a big pond, I'm like, wow, I have to figure out L.A. I need to find a job, what my place is here. And yeah, there's so much poetry going on there that you could do something, you know, multiple venues every day. And so when I first got there, I had like a solid 2 weeks of I'm going to visit every venue, try to find my space, where do I feel comfortable, where is my voice, you know, going to be accepted? Because, you know, not all poetry spots, I could appreciate all poetry, but, you know, do all audiences appreciate me? I had to find out where I belonged. And it was overwhelming, but it was one of the greatest experiences in my life, even though it was very difficult and lonely. to deal with that city that is so ruled by the entertainment industry and all of that money that is not necessarily always looking for art. It's looking for what it can sell. And so that can really crush you. I mean, I'm lucky that I didn't move there at 18. I was like in my 30s when I moved there. It was a totally different experience. Because I took some acting classes there, and I would see people who moved there when they were very young, and they had that hunger to do anything it takes to get famous.
Right.
And I'm really glad I didn't move there with that energy or that need. I'd already moved there like knowing I'm a poet, and these are who I was essentially at the core. So that I didn't feel like I'll do anything to get a Slim Jim commercial. And I definitely saw people who were like did not know themselves, and they'll be like, I'll be anyone you want me to be as long as I get famous. And I was like, wow, that would have been a really dangerous place for me to move at 18.
Yes. And I know too that you've done a lot of work for TV, and you know, that kind of bounces off that idea of starhood and I'll do anything that you'd like. The three seasons that you were on Deaf Poetry must have come while you were fairly young. How did that affect you? Just briefly, and I have to get to having you reading me out of the show in about a minute.
Okay. The show was life-changing. The year before that was when I was on a slam team, Team San Antonio, and we came in second in the nation. And that happened after it aired the first season. And so I think with the second season, the producers contacted PSI and asked them for a short list of, you know, who were the people who did well so that we could see them. And so it was just this whirlwind where they contacted me and asked me to submit a tape. And the next thing I know, I'm on TV. And so I don't know what trajectory I would have taken if I hadn't had validation while I was still young in the writing process. I can't even say if that was like good or bad, because then that like makes you feel like, okay, well, I am there, as opposed to I'm still young and I still need to continue working on the craft. I saw that happen a lot around me. And maybe at times even to myself, where I probably wasn't as humble earlier in my career. But as a performer, it really fed my soul in that I was able to travel and to focus on performing. So a life-changing experience. And like I said, probably for good and bad, but I loved it and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, how could I?
Amalia, we're at the end of our time together. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a real privilege to have you here. And if I could have you read us out of the show now, I would appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, one more time, Amalia Ortiz.
So this is called Lullaby for the Immigrant Ocelot. And this is for all the people, the Trump supporters who want to build a wall and are forgetting that a wall also destroys natural habitat. Oh, mother cat, come race again by my side. Your abandoned kitten anticipates the continuance of your truncated lessons, slashed short by the blade of a wall, standing deadly like a cleaver stuck in meat. I lie and wait for you here in the brush shade by the river. My dignified companions, a number of confused creatures, parted from kin like seas at Moses' feet, the jaguar, the roadrunner, the tortoise, and antelope. They keep me company here by the guillotine fence. I mark the time until you are ready to cross over and join me. Then we will munch on lizards and roam the endless night. I will rest my head once more upon your spotted back and coil in your warmth, our slick mounds gently rising and falling in unison. We will slumber together here in the brush shade by the river. Y me arrullarás hasta que me duerma. For we all drift into sleep, curled tight like a fetus. Then when dreams unfurl, we fan out like fists unclasped or flags stretched long on the horizon. Y me arrullarás hasta que me duerma. That's for the ocelot, endangered species here in South Texas.
Wonderful, Amalia. Thanks again for being on the show. Tune in, and until then, be kind to one another. This is Susan Dobie Chase, Spoken Heard, with Amalia Ortiz.
wishing you a great week.
Thank you.